Welcome to the Living for Food Pod. I wanted to drop an episode last week, but I just felt like with everything going on in the world and, all of this craziness, I thought it would be more respectful to push it a week and drop an amazing episode this week. And that's just what I'm doing. So this week I have someone who I really, really enjoyed speaking to. Her name is Susie, or you may know her as at The Mediterranean Dish on Instagram with over 650,000 followers. Susie has been such an online resource for easy Mediterranean recipes. She has a new cookbook that is out right now, which, like usual, I will link in my Amazon storefront. And she is now a two times New York Times best-selling author. I think this one is really worth listening to. Susie is such an amazing and genuine person, and if you're not following her and her recipes yet, you definitely should be. So please join me in welcoming the lovely Susie. Thank you so much for coming on the Livin' for Food Pod. It's really great to meet you and connect. I was looking at a lot of your recipes this morning and now I'm starving. So
That's
we should wrap
always
this up quick
the
so I can make some food.
goal. Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Of course. I would love to start by talking about your upbringing because at an early age, you aided in your mother's kitchen in Port Said, Egypt. Can you paint a picture for listeners on what cooking for you was like back then?
Yeah, so Port Said is a cosmopolitan Mediterranean city in Egypt, and it's a bit of a melting pot when it comes to food. So there's a lot of Mediterranean, Middle Eastern influence, and a lot of flavors came together on the seashores, as so to speak. So my mom's kitchen just was a busy place full of flavor. And I just sat there all day long doing my homework or whatever it is, and I partook of whatever she was cooking. So it was just kind of the way of life, so to speak.
Did she give you any tasks or were you kind of observing?
I don't remember very many tasks. I left home at the age of 16 to go to college, so I don't remember before that, just other than maybe on occasion when we would be preparing maybe for Easter or Christmas, and she would be making cookies or rolling grape leaves. I would just sit at the table with her and friends, and we would all do this together. The kitchen is really kind of a sacred place all over the Mediterranean and maybe the world too. But in that part of the world, that's where people hung out. And so whenever there is an event or whatever, the ladies are all kind of hanging out in the kitchen together. And so I just was a part of that in general. And I'm sure she put me to work. My mom was a teacher, so I'm sure she
Okay.
did.
Yeah, that would definitely track for
Yeah,
her.
yeah.
Was your mom the type of mom that would always have snacks ready when your friends would come over?
You know, so the snacking bit is not very much a Mediterranean
Oh, okay.
thing. So there was always food. It just was never not there, but it
Okay.
When you think of a snack here, I think at least my kids think when they go to their friends' homes, the snacks are, cookies or crackers or whatever. But back home, the snacks were a meal. So, like, I remember coming home from school in the winter, and the winters there were brutal. And so I would walk in, I'm like super cold. My snack was like a cup of lentil soup. So that would have been my snack. But so when you say snacks, I tend to think of like little meals and meze and like just handheld foods, but not so much a sugary snack after school, if that makes
Oh
sense.
no, that totally makes sense. Us Americans, when I think snack, I think chips, processed foods. I mean, healthy snacks too, but it's kind of gist. But I honestly, that's probably a bit more hearty for you to have little meals like that versus us just reaching for, you know, Tostitos or something like that.
Yeah. And it's the same in, I've traveled all over the Mediterranean. It's the same in Italy, same in Greece. The moms mm-hmm. there, they're always working on something in the kitchen. And if a kid is around, they're feeding the kid, whatever it is that they're cooking. And that's a snack in their opinion. So.
Oh, I'll never complain about that. If you're cooking me pasta for a snack, I'll be totally fine.
Yeah, homemade pasta and everything. So, yeah.
I love it. I am curious too, because I've never traveled to Egypt, but you said it gets freezing in the winter. It gets really cold.
Yeah, it gets cold. So I grew up on the Mediterranean and it's a cold winter. It's pretty mild, but the problem is that the homes are not heated like we have here. So the homes are brick. They're like high rise buildings, all brick. Probably the heaters we had were just smaller heaters all over the house. So not a central system that heated up the entire home, and no insulation. Like the way they build there is completely different. So when we would have like windy and brutal cold days, you really mm-hmm. did feel it, even though it's a lot milder than, you know, we would have here, like say Michigan or Iowa with, you know, 5 feet of snow and that sort of thing. It's just mm-hmm. that the homes aren't heated in the same way. They're not insulated. So we would come home and it's just like we would put on all the things, you know, robes and socks and everything. But
30 layers.
You know, now that I look back on it, it probably wasn't that terrible. It just felt that way.
No, when you're in it, it's terrible. But when you look back, I'm like, oh, sometimes I was a little dramatic.
Yeah, you know, as a little kid, that's what I remember. I just remember that, you know, we came home on a, if it were a cold day, like say in the 60s, that would have been cold. Because it's like really windy and rainy at the same time and everything. And over there, we were just like mostly used to really hot and sunny days. So a couple months of cold weather were just a lot for us to take.
Oh, I get it. Yeah. I moved to LA from East Coast about a year ago. And now I go back and I'm actually freezing at 60 degrees.
Right.
Yeah. I'm like, I can't deal with this anymore. A sweatshirt's not enough. I used to be like loving that weather. Now I'm like wearing a scarf.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's different.
I'm curious where you went to college, because you said you left at 16. Was that in the States you went to college?
I went to school in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I attended Calvin University. It's a small Christian school in Grand Rapids. Prior to that, I finished high school in Canada because we have family there, and I stayed at an aunt's house and finished high school in Toronto and then moved to Michigan for college.
Were those moves a big culture shock for you, or was it kind of easy for you to transition?
Oh no, they were not easy. it was really difficult. I remember the first couple years just being super homesick. Everything was so different, and I remember thinking like the weather was so cold in Toronto and mm-hmm. then in Michigan.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know, initially I thought the snow was so pretty, and then I'm like, no, snow is not that great.
You do until you have to walk in it.
Yeah, no, it's not that great. I'm good. I'd love to go back to the sunshine. But yeah, initially it was really hard the first couple years. Also, the language was difficult for me. I did not grow up speaking English. I did learn it in school just as you maybe would learn French or a second or even third language at school, but not really practicing it. So it was like my first experience at actually having to study entirely in English, read and write and speak and communicate and make new friends and everything else at that age was very, very brutal. So I don't even know how I survived, to be honest, but I did. I did.
I was just thinking that.
It's a hard move to make at that age. Like, you know, teenage moves. I felt when I moved my kids, when we moved from Grand Rapids to like mm-hmm. Iowa and then now to Atlanta, I felt so badly for them, but they were born and raised in the States. So any move we made was within their culture, nothing new. But for me, it was entirely different, entirely. And I'm actually very grateful for it, to be honest.
Well, yeah, it's a hardship that you had to get through. And now you can say, you know, you did it despite it being difficult. But
also when you're 16 or so, it's like your brain is already very developed at that point. So to adopt a whole new language that isn't native to you must be like a whole nother hurdle I can't really even grasp, because every time I've tried to learn a language, I have failed.
So. Well, I feel like the only way to really know a language is to live where the people speak it. Because it's very hard to just like, I knew the alphabet, I knew some grammar, I knew like, you know, your average little stuff here and there. I knew certain words, but I really did not know how to put it all together. And I didn't really know how to communicate in this language. And it just was so limiting those first couple of years. And then it's a time, I think, in your teenage years is when most people have already been together for so many years, going from like middle school to high school, whatever. The cliques had already formed, and here you come, and you're this foreign kid, and you're already like weird. And then people have to, you know, people have to include you in their circles. It wasn't easy. So I feel like the only way I was able to survive it was just to be like, you know, just put on your big kid pants and learn it. And probably humor helped a lot. I was able to laugh at myself often. And that,
were you class clown, or were you just able to
pretty much brush it off? I mean, I would know that I'm like mispronouncing something terribly, and I would just be like all over butchering it. You know, and I'm letting people like make fun along the way because they felt a little more welcome to do that and a little bit more connected. Mm-hmm. Like, it's okay. I know that I don't know the language. And so I had fun with it. And I feel like it just gave me, I developed thicker skin, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, that's when you ask them to pronounce something in Arabic.
Yeah, right, right.
I
can try that, yeah. But I mean, for the most part, people are kind when you're like, hey, I don't know something. And they will be compassionate towards you. And I didn't feel like it was a big deal. I feel like the worst part would be when you are too proud to admit that you aren't fully qualified, you know, you're not there yet. And I tell my team now, I'm not there yet still. Like, I'm still learning. And it's okay. It works. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you're speaking pretty eloquently, I feel like. Well, so
thank
I think you've got it down.
Yeah. I couldn't have imagined, say, writing books, which I do in a new language. But it's definitely been a fun journey.
Right. I know. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around learning a new language and then trying to learn in a new language. That's like a whole nother concept, because you have to like understand what they're saying and then understand what you're trying to learn too.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, that is just like, that's too much for my brain to comprehend.
Yeah. I honestly think when you have to, you just do it. You know what I mean? Like, I had to. There was no choice.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I read on your website that whenever you feel homesick, you run to the farmer's market. Yeah. Has food always been that sign of comfort for you?
Yes, and I didn't realize this until I left home. I didn't realize I would miss food that much or anything. But, like, I would be in the farmer's market and I would just, like, flash back to my days in Port Said in the market with my dad, and how he showed me how to pick the best tomatoes and the best watermelon. And those lessons are in my head. And I just have like when I go to the farmer's market, I feel like, this is where I should be. So it's that place that gives me all the good vibes, so to speak.
Yeah, it's like a safe haven for you to just...
Yeah, even though the market here is completely different, it still has that vibe of like everybody's here, everybody's looking at the produce, the smells of, you know, fresh herbs and, you know, all that. It just is, you know, I try to look for hints of home wherever I go. And I, you know, and one might argue that home is now here for sure, because I've lived in the U.S., a lot longer than I have in Egypt at this point. But still, those early years growing up somewhere else across the world, it doesn't go away. And it's nice to be able
No, you can have multiple.
Yeah,
moms.
Exactly. Exactly.
You don't have to pick
exactly.
One.
And it's nice to be able to like find those common places. You know, and I think
where you just feel secure.
For sure. And I think food, whenever you're at the table with anybody, food is a really powerful tool to get to know someone and to hang out at the table. And I've just been blessed that that's the way I grew up and that's the way I connect with people.
Were the farmers markets in Egypt, were they a lot of hustle and bustle, a lot of maybe chaotic or a little more than the ones that are here? Because I feel like the ones in the US are kind of calm and everyone just walks leisurely.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Like, so if you've traveled in other parts of the Mediterranean, it's probably similar, but like in Egypt, the market's very busy. It's barely like the stands that the different merchants are like next to each other. They're lined up super closely. And it just goes on and on and on. And then it's just a herd of people and there's very little room for you to navigate. So when I would go with my dad, we would have to hold hands super tightly because it's very easy for us to, you know, for me to get lost or whatever. And then people, you know, are calling at you with like the latest and greatest whatever that they just got at the market. And specifically in Port Said, there was a whole fish market because it was like we're right on the Mediterranean. So every day, you know, fresh fish and fresh shrimp and whatever else from the sea. And that alone was a whole experience. So it's loud, it's busy, it's bustling, it smells of all the things at once. And it's lovely. And the people are just like always welcoming and they want you to try the food. So if you're like, you're just walking by and you have no intention of buying the oranges, you have to stop and try them. And that was just part of the thing. And my dad, he's no longer with us, but my dad was a pastor in Port Said and he was so well loved and known in the community. So whenever I would go with him on those souk days, on those market days, for him, it was a lot more than just going to grab some food to make. It was more like that was actually a time on his calendar to go check on these people and check on the community and talk to different people. So it was for him was making sure that he stopped at as many places as possible. So it was a leisurely day, but also for him, it was more about like, we're not here to just gather our, you know, food and go. We are here to talk to this person and this man and this woman and this lady over there and that person over there because they mean something and they need to know that we care. So we would go and talk to all these people and we would have to sample every single thing. And it was just like by the time we went home, there was no need to really eat dinner, but we'd already had like the fresh oranges, the beautiful whatever was sold that day, we sampled it. And it's just there's this certain generosity of heart in that part of the world that is really unique.
How interesting that both your mom and your dad had such a big part in your food journey, but both kind of in different landscapes. Like your mom always was cooking and probably you were learning from her, but then your dad really fostered the community side of it. Do you feel like that is what helps you create the community that you have now?
Yes, absolutely. And it wasn't anything that they intentionally, like they wouldn't sit us down and go, food is a big deal. They just showed us that food was a big deal.
Right, right.
You know, so because growing up in a pastor's home in that part of the world was kind of unique too, because people would just show up anytime they needed something. And he was sort of like a person in the community that people sought out for different things, not just because they went to church, but because, you know, they would run into an issue and they needed to talk to my dad, and his door was always open, not just in the office, but at home. So people would just come knock on the door and it might be almost dinner time and suddenly we have a few extra guests at the table and it was just fine. And my mom would just pull whatever in the fridge and make a feast of it. And it was like not a big deal at all. And I think in that regard, I'm so blessed because I'm never afraid to have people over. I'm never afraid to, like, if even on a, you know, last minute someone is in town and they call up, I'm like, hey, come for dinner. It's no big deal. Because I feel like I don't think about it so hard because my family never did. We just shared what we had. And I think there's just something about that. I feel like our lives here can get so busy and so we're so yes. confined by our calendars and by our, you know, activities.
Tell me about it.
Right? And all these different things that it's yes. like, well, if I really wanted to see a friend, I'd have to make, you know, an appointment a month ahead and be like, can we meet for coffee? And sometimes it's a back and forth to meet for coffee when it's just like a half hour situation. And that was really not my experience growing up. And I'm trying to make sure that I have a bit of that spontaneous, you know, which is not always possible, but have a bit of that spontaneous thing of like, even though I may not have a full feast in my fridge, I'd really rather see my friend if they're in town for a night. And I'm just going to invite them over, even if we're going to just sit around and have cheese and crackers or whatever it is, you know?
No, I understand that deeply. I learned that I am shackled to my calendar. And I'm just at this point, it's like I have to schedule things several months out. And if like a friend wants to come visit, I'm like, I just, you know, it's not going to work unless you tell me at least 2 months yeah. ahead of time. So I feel like I do have to get a little better at being spontaneous like that, because it's just, you're never going to see anyone.
Yeah, it's hard. Ever. And I think also another part about, you know, even in my new cookbook, which is coming out, which is out mm-hmm. this year, it's called Simply Dinner. And the whole point of it is kind of to try to not necessarily debunk, but help people kind of get our heads, all of us, around the idea that dinner does not have to be such a chore and it doesn't have to be such a big to-do. There are ways to make it a more joyful, less stressful occasion, whether it's just for you and a small family, just for yourself, or for a big group. And I feel like one question that's always come up since I started writing about food, people are always wondering, like, well, how do you cook every day? Or how do you put dinner on the table every day? I really don't. Right. But I don't really think hard about that. Like, I don't have that stress. And I feel a lot of us have an expectation of what a meal needs to look like. And we kind of we've built yes. this whole thing in our heads that it needed to be this big labor of love. And, you know, that you had to toil so much. And so it just became like dinner time became synonymous with a chore, and it's just
right.
You don't have a great feeling about it, you know. And so the whole thing about like simplifying dinner, it's a two part situation. First, like mentally ditch all this labor of love situation. Keep the love, that's fine. You can ditch the labor. and then just look into what you have on hand, because there are ways to make dinner so fast and without thinking so hard.
Yeah, I think too, and I feel like I've been guilty of this too, just with the culture I've grown up in, is that easy dinners can sometimes equate to being lazy.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I threw together this super healthy dinner. Maybe it's literally just rice, vegetables, and yeah. chicken or something. But then I'm like, that was kind of lazy of me. Like, I could have done better. But then when you think about it, you're getting all your food groups in, and it right. did the job, you know? And spices are very powerful. So all you have to do is throw like a few spices in, and you don't have to go crazy. So I think the concept is very smart. And I want to, now that we're on your cookbook, which is coming out September 24th yeah. next week, which yeah. is very exciting. This will be out when the cookbook is out. So how is this cookbook process different from the first one you launched a few years ago? Or was it virtually kind of the same deal?
Well, so the first book I wrote 2 years ago was more just kind of like setting the table and explaining where I came from and my food philosophy and the people who influenced my food. And it was, it had some traditional recipes, but also still pretty easy just for the average North American cook. And I will be the first to admit, I'm a very lazy cook. If I have to be in the kitchen too many hours, I'm just not excited about it. I'm more motivated to spend time with people. So that's just me as a person. I love being around people. So I don't want to be deprived of their presence by simply just being in the kitchen. And I want to serve them and I want to make them a great meal and everything, but I don't want to miss out on being with people. So, but the second book really addresses the issue of dinner time and not just how to make dinner time more like easier, but also more joyful. So it is the Mediterranean Just Simply Dinner, and it's 125 easy Mediterranean diet inspired recipes to eat well and live joyfully. That's the whole point of it. And so the way that the chapters are kind of broken up, it's kind of by dinner solutions and smart ways to make dinner time a lot less stressful for you. So there's like cozy one pot section. There is a, you know, sheet pans. There is a grilling section that's kebabs and such. And there is also a mezze day mix and match, just small little plates that you can mix and match and make a dinner of them. Kind of like when the whole girl dinner thing went viral on Instagram yeah. or on social media, I had to chuckle because that's a very Mediterranean thing. There isn't really like, this is a girl mm-hmm. dinner. It's like if you slice up some tomatoes and add some feta cheese, drizzle some olive oil and a few fresh herbs on it, that's a meal to me. I'm good with that meal.
That sounds delicious.
So, you know what I mean? So I feel like that. So the book, the Simply Dinner book, is like centered around dinner solutions that will give you that relief back, I hope. And will maybe, hopefully, will inspire you to get excited about dinner time because it's no longer that big chore. So it's an invitation for all of us to ditch the labor, but keep the love, peace, but ditch the labor. And an invitation to just like, you know what, maybe let's look at what if dinner time didn't have to be a chore? What if dinner time became this life-giving experience for the entire family? What if dinner time didn't have to be this big feast? It could be this small assortment of things from the fridge that you can give a new life to, you know, just with a few little things that you can jazz them up. So I went to work on this second book immediately after my first book was out, only 1 month after, because that question had been coming up over and over and over. How do I do dinner time? How do I get dinner on the table every single day? I don't have the time or I don't have the energy. Well, this book will show you that you can put dinner on the table a lot quicker than you would stand in line at a fast food restaurant.
I would love to ditch the labor in most aspects of my life.
And you will find.
If I could do a shortcut, I'm going to take the shortcut.
You will find that there is actually a way. And I think it's a practice. I think we have to be intentional about it. So in terms of food, people of the Mediterranean, they don't sweat food choices so much. We don't worry about, at least from my experience, and even from my travels, I just came back from Greece. People just are joyful around food, and they aren't worried so much about, like, oh my gosh, there's not a feast on the table. But somehow, with a few ingredients, they put a feast on the table that's so exciting and delicious. They just don't think about it so hard. And I think maybe overthinking it, maybe expectations of perfectionism and maybe whatever it is, it's a combination of things that have just driven us here in our busy society to feel like there's just absolutely no way around it. But we can ditch all that if we want to.
You're talking to the right person because when I host, I absolutely love hosting and I love cooking for other people and having them enjoy it. But I'm such a perfectionist that like it can get more stressful for me than fun. So I've I need to let go of that a little bit. So I've taken a step back from hosting things because it just gets stressful for me because I want it to be perfect and just look good too. And then have everyone be happy. And then the whole time I'm just worried. I'm like, do they like this? Do they like this? Maybe they hate this, whatever. And then I can get in my head about it. So I think it's important to take a step back and say, okay, does it really matter that much? Or does it matter more that you're just surrounded with your friends?
Exactly. And you'll find that most people are just very grateful to be lavished upon in this way.
Included.
Because to cook for somebody is a very special thing. If you make a meal for anybody, no matter how big or small the meal is, it's a very special thing. So most people are grateful for it.
Have your daughters kind of adapted your love for cooking and being around people too? I'm not sure how young they are, so I don't know.
So they are not so tiny. They are 22 and 14.
Oh, okay. So then you know the answer.
So they have been exposed to it. They, you know, my oldest is feeding herself on a daily basis. She has her friends over in her own place now. And
that's impressive.
And she's pretty healthy. So it's, you know, she's knows what to eat on and does not spend a whole lot of money on fast food. My little one who's 14 loves the kitchen. She loves to move out and she really is crazy about spices and flavors, and she will be like, how about we put this on top? How about we add this? You know what, mommy? You need to pass me this, you know, particular spice. I want to add that to my salad. So she does definitely have a flair for it. But again, it's not like I sat them down and said, you had to do this. They just, like I did with my mom, they just are around it enough that they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I know how to do that.
Yeah, and they don't necessarily need to be like a connoisseur in it, but they could just be appreciative and learn from it.
Absolutely. I think children in general just, you know, they learn by watching us. And
yes, that's true.
Whatever we say doesn't really matter. They want to see it happening. Like if I am happy cooking and I'm, you know, I'm enjoying myself and I'm throwing things in the pot and I'm like, the music is on and, you know, people are in and out of the kitchen and I'm not so stressed out about it. They're absorbing that. And they're like, oh, mommy's having fun. And in turn, it all kind of, maybe it's weird to say this, but I think like your attitude is reflected in what you do, right? Anything you do.
Oh, that's not a weird thing to say.
Right? So even when it comes to food, if you're happy and you're putting in the love and the excitement into it, even if it was a humble meal, the people around you are like, oh, wow, this is great. And that's with family too. I think a lot of times when we show our stress in certain situations in a bad way,
it shows.
Then the whole joy of gathering at the table is kind of sucked out of it. And so this, I really wanted for this particular book to kind of just dig a little bit deeper into, you know, this philosophy of living the Mediterranean way, and particularly at the table, what does that look like? Because our health, our well-being doesn't just depend on the ingredients that are in the food, but also gathering at the table and enjoying that community and that communal activity of having a meal together and pouring our hearts out and breaking bread, so to speak, with one another, that has a big effect on our well-being. So I feel like a lot of times we don't focus on that part of eating, or that part of eating the Mediterranean way, for sure. That's a big part of the Mediterranean culture, that community, that gathering, that experience of being together. It's a major deal. I don't know if you've watched like the Blue Zone series and other things about the Blue Zones community.
No, I haven't.
So the Blue Zones are those six areas all over the world, but a couple of them, at least a couple of them, are Mediterranean. And that's where people live the longest. So
isn't there like a town in Italy?
Yes, Sardinia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sardinia, Italy, and Icaria, Greece are two places that are considered, within the blue zones, but there are many parts of the Mediterranean where people live quite long as well, but those two like absolutely exceed. And when they looked into their lives, there wasn't a whole list of like, no, we don't eat this, we eat that. There was not a whole list of like, there wasn't a whole diet that's restrictive in the way that we experience diet here. So it's not like, oh, I have eliminated like entire food groups from my life and that's why I live long. Not at all. These people are not thinking so hard about every single choice they make in food, but naturally, because they are eating what the earth has given them and they are making the time to be with family and community, and they have a bigger purpose in life than counting calories and macros and all that jazz, they're living longer accidentally almost. They're not really even thinking about it. So when they've discovered these places and people are like, oh, what? I'm in the blue zones? Like, you think it's weird that I've lived this long? It's because they're not even thinking about it. They're just accidentally living long because they have committed to just these practices of generosity toward each other, this practice of community, this practice of like eating in seasons, walking everywhere you need to go, and just the Mediterranean life. And so part of my mission, and I'm talking your ear off now because I'm so...
No, that's why we're here.
I'm so passionate about this, but part of my mission is like, you know, let's start with dinner time. Let's just make that a little bit easier and more joyful for everyone.
Right. And I think too, and this is just something I've noticed in my own life and just American culture, as, you know, families, as kids grow up and everything, it can just become easier to eat your meals separately. Yeah. And then you kind of lose that togetherness. That's kind of what we've done as we've gotten older, because everyone has such different schedules, or we're all eating differently, or someone doesn't like this or someone doesn't like that. So like, it's harder for everyone to set a time for dinner, or for all of us to sit. So then we just like watch it in front of the television, or we just, I mean, that's actually basically it. That's what I do.
Yeah. So. But you know what? Then don't feel so terribly about some of that, because sometimes we don't really have a choice. But let's try to, when we have a choice, let's try to do it, you know, because I feel like I don't ever want people to feel like I'm shaming you for your style of eating or whatever. You can do whatever feels right to you. The whole guilt aspect of our culture is another layer too that we add to almost everything that we do.
Yes, it is.
It's dinner time. And so it's like, you know what? It's okay that on Wednesday nights, everybody has to do so many different things and we don't meet until like 8 o'clock. Well, do we have a half hour at 8 o'clock maybe to just sit around and have a piece of fruit together and just like chat about our day? Maybe it's not necessarily the real big meal that we're at the table together for, but maybe it's just like, hey, let's have some tea, or let's have, you know, let's just sit around and, you know, decompress and have a little bit of FaceTime, even though it's not a part of the meal. So, but as much as I can, my family is always eating at the table together, weirdly enough, for so many years. And it's just is the way it is. But I know that for some other families, that's not possible.
No, that's a really good point to say that, like, it's not always going to be possible for everyone else to have a family look like another family who's all wholesome and eating together. And everyone's very different. So you do have to find what works for you. Did your youngest daughter, did she help you with this cookbook at all? Since she loves to like tell you about
she's
seasons.
She's in it.
Is she in it? Okay. I didn't.
Yeah, we've done some, you know, definitely my family is the first to taste anything I make for the book. And they're the first and biggest critics. So, like, if they didn't like something, it would not be in the book.
So, did you get brutal honesty from her?
Yeah, always, always. And sometimes if she's around and she's not busy, she'll help me prep and do whatever.
Yeah, she helped you. I'm curious too, because Mediterranean dishes are very vegetable heavy. You know, you like to pride yourself in using bold flavors. Is there an unexpected flavor combination you found yourself using in this book?
It wouldn't be unexpected to me, but maybe to the average, to other people
okay. who
are, you know, maybe a little bit new to it. But some of the seasonings I use, like I use za'atar a lot, which is Mediterranean wild thyme, sesame seed, and sumac. It's really herby and bold. I love it so much. I use harissa paste, which is more North African and
okay.
still like a bit spicy. It's basically a pepper paste. I think the thing that might surprise people about this book is that it's not about one part of the Mediterranean, but all.
Oh, okay.
So because the Mediterranean is quite large, it's more than 20 countries touching the Mediterranean. And so the flavor profiles will differ from one place to another. And for me, I'm sort of a rebel. And sometimes I'm like, no, I don't care if this is North African. If I want to make a harissa pasta, I'm going to make a harissa pasta. You know, where you think pasta is Italian, harissa is Tunisian and North African, I can use the two together and they will happily live and nothing will happen. This book has a little bit of that sort of vibe of mixing a little bit of these different seasonings in unexpected ways, but they don't surprise me. I'm like quite comfortable with it. I love to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pushing the boundaries a little bit. That doesn't really surprise me either because you said Egypt was such a melting pot. So I'm sure that's where a lot of your influence is coming
yeah.
from. I would love to know. Oh, well, also you have a single source like olive oil and fresh spices on your website
yes.
too. So where are you sourcing those from? Is that coming from the Mediterranean?
Yes, different parts of the Mediterranean. So our olive oils. So, yeah, when you're on the MediterraneanDish.com, if you hit the shop tab, that's where all the things that I use are. Our olive oils come from Greece, Italy, Spain at this point in time. And so
yeah,
we are
okay.
sourced from those places. We have spices that are sourced from different parts of the Mediterranean, depending on what spice. But we do have some great collaborations and some great people helping us bring it all together.
That's incredible. There's nothing better than going to Europe or something and bringing back fresh spices. I still have a bunch that I've been using.
Yeah.
And you can just tell the difference between like the dried basil I bought at the store and the dried basil I bought there. It's like such a game changer.
Yeah, we have the same thing with oregano. Our oregano comes from Greece. And Greek oregano
nice.
Is completely different from what from the little jars that you buy at the store. And I love to use the wild, like, on the stem oregano, which we have.
That's what I have, too.
In the store. Mm-hmm. And it's just so much, it's bold and beautiful. And people, when they begin to try these flavors, they kind of get hooked. And they know that they can transform something so simple into a glorious meal just because they've used a combination of spices in it.
No, that's so true, because even the bottled ones I have, I feel like I'm using so much of
yes.
it and it's really not even getting the flavors I want. And then I'll use like a little bit of that oregano stem and it's like you can smell it
yeah.
before you even put it in. And it's just is like a total change in what I was making.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, you should try to get spices originated from other places
yeah.
if you're able.
Yeah.
It's a life-changing experience.
And they last. I have mine. They last a while. So it's not a wasted investment. It can surely make a difference. A good pantry can make a difference in making dinner a lot
oh, for
easier
sure.
and more exciting.
I was looking through your YouTube channel as well. Is there a recipe on there that you didn't expect to do really well, but then people just keep coming back and are like, I love this recipe?
Oh, that has happened several times. Let me think here. There is one video for a simple sautéed cabbage that all over
oh.
social media, I call it sexy cabbage, and it's the weirdest thing because it's just...
Oh, I just saw that on your Instagram.
Just a funny thing. And every time I post that, this is like several times now, but the first time I posted it, it got a couple million views, and I just could not figure out
mm-hmm.
why. just cabbage, right? So cabbage sauteed with onions and garlic, a few warm spices, cumin, that sort of thing. And then I finish it up with a feta cheese dressing. And it's really good. Yeah. It's a really good recipe. I just didn't think while filming it that that was going to be the recipe to, you know, go viral or anything like that. Because it's like, oh, it's cabbage. Like, cabbage is such a humble ingredient. And, you know, we don't use it very much. Or a lot of people don't really think of it as a something to make a real dish with. Maybe just a salad or, you know, that sort of thing. But not necessarily a dish.
Yeah, no, at least speaking for like what the U.S. says, like we don't really often include cabbage as a leafy green that we go to. We just have regular lettuce, arugula, spinach. But I think it's probably because that one we don't use as much, but also the recipe was just so simple. Yeah. And once you add like a cheesy dressing to it, everyone's going to love it.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the big three.
Right? Yeah.
The perfect recipe for you.
Sure. Yeah. I think simple is good and it surprises people. And that's when they're like, mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to make that. Another recipe that's, I think, also on YouTube is a garlic balsamic chicken recipe. That's just.
Oh, yeah. That's a good classic.
You whip up a little marinade and the chicken goes in it and then it all goes in the oven. And if you're really maybe spend 10 minutes of your time doing it, but it's such a great recipe. So it's something I make often and people like it.
Ooh, I actually have to make that. Sometimes I just get so bored with chicken, which I know a lot of people do too, but I just need to think of other ways. So I'm going to look through your website later and look
at that recipe. They have multiple, many, many chicken recipes. So.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure you do. I would love to talk about what's next for you. I always ask, aside from the cookbook, do you have any other upcoming projects you would like to share? Anything else going on?
I have a couple of projects, but I can't talk about them yet.
Okay, that's okay. But
they're going to be so exciting, I promise.
Hey, that's something. Yeah, that's something you can get people excited for.
For sure. Yeah. And we're always working on the site, always adding new things, always exploring extra things to bring to our shop. And it's just been a fun ride. This is our 10th year now. So we're celebrating our 10th anniversary for the MediterraneanDish.com. So,
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
That's so incredible. Well, do you remember when you posted your first blog, how that felt?
Yeah, I did not feel a thing, honestly. I was like, at first it was just simply like a place to document these recipes for my daughters. I wasn't thinking it was going to be anything major. And so those first couple years, I didn't really care. I didn't think so hard about it. I just put stuff that I think I want my kids to be able to make at some point. And then slowly but surely, people began to email me saying, hey, I was prescribed the Mediterranean diet and I bought these books and they're so difficult to cook from. And I'm so glad I found your stuff. And then it dawned on me that, I'm doing something for other people. And that's really when my focus shifted to helping other people in that way. And it's been a joy and I'm really grateful for it. And our team has really grown a lot since then. So I really am not the one to take credit anymore.
Well, I mean, that seems very parallel to what your dad used to do because people used to go to him all the time to talk about their life or advice, like you mentioned. So that's interesting that you've kind of taken on that role, but in the internet space and people come to you. Do you get messages a lot like that?
I get a lot of emails when people are just, it's very emotional sometimes to talk about because some of it is very personal to their journeys and they send the email saying, you know, I had a heart attack and then I was diagnosed with this and that. And then I was turned on to the Mediterranean diet and without this site, I wouldn't have had the ability to, you know, continue on my health journey. And we get our team reads through. In fact, we have a person dedicated to reading these, one full-time person who reads all the comments and all the messages and emails. And they really do make a difference. They are the reason why we continue to do what we do, because we know that it matters to someone out there.
And they'll appreciate you responding and your team responding, because that's sometimes the difference, especially when you're, you know, on a screen so often, or they're reading a blog, you can be a little detached from your community. But when you're able to actually talk to them and then respond to them, I'm sure they appreciate that. And then they'll keep up with everything that you've been doing too, because it's changed their life.
They have changed my life too. So, and I'm really grateful for, you know, it's not lost on me that there are so many resources out there that people can partake of. There are so many books that people can be buying. So they're partaking of my products and my resources. That to me is really a vote of confidence, and it makes a lot of difference and keeps us going as a team. And this year or last year, we were able to begin hiring, and this had been a long time dream of mine. We were able to implement a contributor program and hire chefs and writers from all over different parts of the Mediterranean who are able to now share their voice and their culture and their recipes, you know, from Spain, Italy, Greece, Lebanon. I'm forgetting some places, but we have Iranian, a lot of different flavors on our site. And it's been exciting to see more and more names on the site. When I started, it was just me. But as of years ago, we began to implement bringing in other people to write and to share their stories and recipes.
That's so sweet. You seem like such a sincere person. So I feel like you deserve everything that is coming your way. You're like this one, so sweet, honestly.
Thank you. I am grateful for it all. And
it seems like you are.
Yeah, I really am. And I'm just really excited and nervous to see what happens with this new book and if it will be as successful and as loved as the first one. It's always like, oh man, but the first one was so great and it made the New York Times list. And now I'm just like, hopefully this is new.
I know. It's like, can we do it again? It's that kind of extra pressure,
but
right?
Also, if not, it's okay. Hopefully it helps somebody out there.
I always say, like, I wrote an article the other day that was a little bit more vulnerable for me about my eating habits than, you know, I'm used to. And one of my friends reached out to me. She was like, you know, I really appreciated you writing this. And I told her too, I was like, even if it just helps like one person, like one young girl out there or one person out there, you know, it was worth being a little bit honest and putting your work into it.
There's really nothing, absolutely zero to lose when you are honest and sharing something that will contribute to someone else's well-being. And honestly, like in our lifetime right now, like what's happening in the social media space, and there's a lot of content that is not, what's the word, that is not life-giving, so to speak. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of
negativity.
But also, on the other hand, even when people are being positive, they're not always being sincere. And there's a ton of just, there's a veneer. There is a different, people are living through, I don't know, the influencer space, so to speak. Mm-hmm. People are living through others and are looking and comparing. And it's a whole, I think a whole challenge for us to bring about, like for you, for me, for other people who are actually honestly wanting to bring about change and good information that will be helpful to someone's well-being. Nothing lost when you are vulnerable, when you are in that space where you can say, listen, this is what it is, and I hope this helps somebody. Congratulations that you're able to do that.
Oh, well, thank you. I know. I feel like I can get frustrated when I see like one of those videos that kind of masquerades as being helpful.
Yeah.
And you know, in the back of your mind that people are susceptible to that, especially children who are going through all that. And I was like, dang, I had it hard in middle school and younger, but yeah. I can only imagine what's going on in their heads now.
It's really hard. Mm-hmm. Hard. And so we have to be able, when we can, we have to stand up for what is true and what is good. And that's all we can do.
Well, I'm very excited for your cookbook to come out. I have a feeling it'll do just as good as the first one, if not better. So. And if it doesn't, that is blasphemy.
I hope so. Thank you so much, Olivia.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I have one final question for you that's kind of a fun one, and I ask every single guest to lighten the convo a little bit.
Okay.
If there is one cooking utensil or appliance you think everyone should splurge on, what would it be and why?
Someone should splurge on one appliance. Okay, so I'm not a gadgety person, so this is going to be very boring. But I say a nice Dutch oven or a large pot that can handle, that can handle like a lot of heavy duty. So I have a couple of those because I'm always like, I'm a soup person. I like to make one pot things all the time. And that's one of the things I always go to. A nice cast iron skillet is never a bad idea, but those aren't such a big splurge either. You know, to be honest, I bought myself a rice cooker one day a long time ago. I gave it away because I don't use it. I also thought, at some point, the Instant Pot was a big deal. I think it is still.
I think it
people,
is. Yeah.
People use it very well. I gave that one away also because I only used it once. And I was like, this is not simpler and it's not quicker. And it's like I just didn't think it was helping my life. So I'm just a really traditional, like, buy yourself a good pot, a few good utensils, and you're good to go.
Okay. I'm sure you have these recipes on your website too, but I do have a Dutch oven. And what do you make in it besides soup? Because I haven't honestly looked into this much, but I feel like there's other things I can do with it.
Yeah. I mean, you could do something like if you're wanting to try something like a lamb tagine or something, and you don't want to buy the special pot that, is the Moroccan tagine, you can just use the Dutch oven and make a nice, beautiful lamb tagine in it and just stick it in the oven, let it braise until it's nice and melty. You can braise a lot of meats in it. You could make a whole roast chicken in it. So many different things.
I totally forgot that I could just like cook meat and stuff in that.
Yeah.
That is very smart. I honestly didn't look too far into it because I was a little lazy, but now I'm going to do that. Maybe I'll do that later.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Of course. Well, this has been a joy.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you so, so much for coming on. This was very lovely. I'm excited to see everything that is going on in the future. And if you're in LA, if you ever do a book tour or anything like that.
I am. I'm doing a book tour. I will be in LA later in October, I think.
Ooh, all right. I'll check it out. Maybe see if I can.
It's on our site, the book tour. So you'll see.
Okay, sweet. Yeah. I'll check that out.
Hey, fellow foodies. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave me a review. While you're at it, make sure to follow me at Livin' for Food Pod on Instagram or TikTok, or email me at livinforfoodpod@gmail.com. Let me know what you're cooking up this week, which guests you would like to see on the podcast, or tell me your opinions on the latest viral food trend. And in case you're just joining me, there is an entirety of season 1 ready and waiting for you. Until next time.